You begin to perceive into the etheric world, the anima mundi of the planet. And if it comes too harshly for you, you see strange things there. If you want to know what I mean, look at the bottom of the sea and look at the extraordinary creatures that are there with lights hanging from tentacles. Pale creatures which brought to the surface just explode, die, too much change in pressure. They are the nearest to etheric beings that we can apprehend. It's just as if the etheric world is there, and there's the bottom of the sea with this immense pressure, and these etheric beings can come into our world there. The etheric world, the Hyperborean continent described by Annie Besant. We begin to look into it. And I don't mean to hurt anybody when I write about UFOs and say that they are illusions. I really do believe that most of these people see these flying saucers, these unidentified flying objects. But it's because they have momentary, at least, etheric vision. And the surge of anxiety in the world and stress creates the kind of disks and orbs and things that can be frequently seen, added to by the person's own apprehension of what he's looking at. I told you the last time I was here, I looked through a bed of tulips, red tulips, and a car arrived. And I saw the car through the tulips. And I said, oh, a red car's arrived. And I would swear by everything holy that that car was red when I saw it. And that's the kind of sensitivity that I'm talking about. And when you get moments of stress, and perhaps your blood sugar's dropped a little bit, and you're a little hypoglycemic, or you're over-breathing, then you get flashes of the inner worlds coming into your consciousness, just like that there. And of course, you have to be very careful, because if you blabbed about it, didn't keep it secret, and people would tell you, you're off your rocker. And if you told your husband, he'd make a note of it in his diary. And eventually he would put you in a lunatic asylum if you weren't careful, quoting from the diary directly. Sensitivity, awareness of other planes, yes, but other globes. Madame Blavatsky talked about worlds within worlds. And we are within many, many worlds where we are on the earth. We are the grossest of the worlds. And they are there and we can look into them. Sensitivity. The body is an eye. The body is an eye. The whole aura is an eye. Your consciousness may be the central point of it. But the eye is there nevertheless. You don't see with the whole eye. In fact, you don't see with the eye at all. You see through electrical phenomena at the back of the brain. You don't see light, as anyone who studied the subject could tell you. And it is then that we begin to have expressions of the signposts on the path. The signposts that tell you how far you are, what you can expect round the corner. Signposts of spiritual unfoldment. And you're not surprised when your whole nature becomes electrical. I once saw a Zulu boy coming into, he'd just got this job in this hotel, and he'd He'd come into the hotel and was employed on clearing the bins in the rooms. And he walked down this passage on the nylon carpet. And the first door handle that he touched, for him it must have blown up in his face. He got this massive shock. And he had to be comforted. He had to go and have a consultation with his friends. He had never known anything like it, that lightning was coming out of the handles of the doors. And it had to be pointed out to him that the way you dragged your feet affected the charge that you got off the, and so on. And it's that, as an analogy I use, to show you that your nature becomes electrical, extraordinary, extraordinarily electrical. You witness something traumatic in the street. Somebody's nearly knocked down, there's a screech of brakes, you see a person jerk back. And as that happens, there's an electric shock in the saliva, seems to be, under the tongue, the front of the tongue. Whether fillings in the teeth have anything to do with it, I don't know. But that's the kind of thing that begins to happen when the aura begins to act as an eye, as a receiver, as a sensitive organ. Signposts on the path. We begin to see and hear. As that little story I just read to you, of the old father saying to the son, well, all right, you've been to university and you've learned everything. But have you ever heard voices which don't come from anybody, but are in the silence? That's what he was saying to him. Well, that's the person treading the path. And that is what you must expect. To see the inner worlds and see their colors. To see the extraordinary colors in the astral world, the higher planes of the astral, especially in the higher planes of the astral, which are laterally next to the heaven worlds. Seven planes of the astral. Seven planes of the mental world, which stop about there, and this begins the heaven world, all the planes from then on. And so you can, by a vertical elevation of your mind, penetrate into the heaven world, or a lateral one, laterally into the plane of Manas. And when you're in the astral world, the interplay laterally with the heaven world is very intense if you can reach up to these higher planes in the astral. And of course, that's the whole point of purifying the nature, is to be able to float up, if you like, if you can't do it in any other way, float up to the higher subplanes of the astral, and then you are laterally very close to the heaven world. And the colors there are gorgeous. Your eyes are no good for picking them up. You have to develop color apprehension. So now you get the drift of this. And you must learn to hear inner noises. That's why I told you that story, to hear inner noises. You make big mistakes like that. I shouldn't laugh at people who've seen flying saucers. When I was a medical student, stop me if you've heard this one. When I was a medical student, we used to bunk off from medical classes and go down to Muizenberg, where there was a nice stretch of beach, and swim. And, of course, like all other guys there, you'd pick up ear infections from not drying your ears out. Anyway, it was the day, it was the time in 1958 where there were satellites going all around the Earth and people were seeing flying saucers and Adamski had been on the back of the moon, and it was an amazing time. And I was caught up with this. I met people who I knew would not be lying, who tell me about these objects. And one day I was studying in my bedroom, and my mind was going over the particular problem. Suddenly I thought I heard Morse code. I listened carefully. My God, that's in my ear. So I listened more carefully, went on for several days, and I thought, it's flying saucers. They're trying to contact me. Well, in the atmosphere of that time, it was easily possible to come to such conclusions. And this went on, and I began to take it down because I knew Morse code, and got a lot of nonsense, of course, jumbled up, and asked, I was in touch with the master at that stage, what it was. And he put through what I call a lucigram, light picture, put through a lucigram, which showed the great big thing of the central ear, cochlea of the middle ear, and a few other things. And it indicated to me that I had got an ear infection and I was picking up tinnitus. And this tinnitus happened to be at the note of one of our Morse code devices. And I could be sitting there still, perhaps in a lunatic asylum, picking up messages. Obviously, the next stage would have been that I would have said, ah, I can't understand it because it's in code. So you've got to have a good, or at least a modicum of good sense when you deal with these things, especially with regard to noises, because it's allied to schizophrenia. The hearing of noises, the hearing of sounds, the hearing of voices, voices that scold you, voices that praise you, and so on. And it is a difficult matter, this, of extending your sensitivity and making absolutely sure that you are discriminating the real from the unreal. One of the sounds that one has to possibly come into, I don't know whether you all have it, but you hear this sound. The sound when this happens, and thought, 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 and then a pause, no thinking. And that, for me, being as I am, I heard it as the sound of dove's wings fluttering, as those and that I found was the diminishment of the thought waves for me. But it was good to know. And when you become so sensitive, and you do, remember always, when you sit in silence, your senses become more aware, but at the same time, in silence, the soul, the inner self, disseminates, grows. So you have this dual action. So the fact of the matter is that you have to develop your sensitivity, but not go crackers. And one of the things you have to learn is occult silence. Occult silence. Sometimes you can be bursting to tell a person your dream or your experience. You have to learn to control such urges. You can have a confidant. We recommend confidants at Claregate. Each person should have a confidant. You can have confidants, providing you know the confidant and the person keeps a secret, as confidants should. Or you may just exchange certain things with a confidant and not others. I'm trying to help. I'm not putting it in a phraseology that is so obscure that you need 20 dictionaries to unravel it. You begin to develop esolepsy. And by esolepsy, we mean the condition that arises when you turn inwards. Esolepsy. And this is a heightened awareness. I know the tendency is when you begin to read about these things that, you go into a cataleptic state and the senses die down and so on. Well, it hasn't been my experience. My experience is that the kind of consciousness I want to be identified with spiritually is a consciousness that is heightened, and the condition of esolepsy tells you that your senses are, it's just as if you're trying to apprehend something which is fed with air. Then you switch it over to oxygen. And what you're picking up becomes highly more refined, and you can hear almost anything. You certainly will hear the blood in the carotid artery rushing past the middle ear. You certainly will hear, if you live in a reasonably silent place, you will certainly hear the contraction of the masseter muscles on the jaw. You will, because they're so close, and you'll hear the as they are relaxing or when they come into play again. Sensitivity. Well, I say you also begin to hear your brain waves. You don't have to hear them, therefore the phenomenon dies away. I would say that each one of you needs to have at least one breathing exercise that you can call on in an emergency. Doesn't matter too much which one it is. Don't let the yogis terrify you about what kind of breathing exercise you're doing. The bellows breath, to my mind, is the best. Sometime we'll have a session on that. The bellows breath, the sharp intake of breath through the nose, which heightens the senses. And so if you're researching something and you're penetrating, you're going in, you're developing the ability to go in on something, perhaps way back in time, the bellows breath can help you at that razor's edge. Expect all sorts of phenomena related to the vagus nerve. We'll deal with them in a later session. Thank you. Lunchtime now. We come now to the subject of Maya, one of the most difficult in the language of the ancient wisdom. The Western mind is always upset when it is first told that this world is an illusion, because palpably it obviously is not. Its solidity, we say, fools us. In fact, according to the esoteric teachings, this material solidness is a sham, and we're going to see that. And if you don't see it, you shouldn't touch anything more to do with the esoteric, because you will be handicapped, very handicapped indeed, if you can't see this proposition with your own eyes. No one is suggesting that there's nothing in this room. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that what is coming into our consciousness is only a mockery of what the situation really is. We are misinformed by our senses. When I was younger and more robust, I used to say, call the senses the liars of consciousness. But I don't do that anymore. Ultimately, matter and energy are interchangeable. Matter and energy are interchangeable. Now, that is not ancient wisdom only. We've said that for thousands of years. All is energy. One of the first things I learned when I came onto the path, all is energy. The fact that matter is convertible into energy and energy into matter is an important point because it establishes how strong the mind can be, for the mind can control energy. The mind can move energy. Energy follows thought. Energy follows thought. One of the first powers that will be released to science, which have formerly been in the esoteric field, will be this matter of mind being able to move objects. The tennis ball is moved by the racket, but also by the man propelling the ball, the player himself. And there's no arguments about it. This telekinesis is a fact of life. And the New Age will prove it. So let me plow on very sedately into this field. Is the material world an illusion? We are told by very eminent people in history that our cities, our homes, our furniture, our money are all deception, that they are only fragments of reality. We are told that even the physical body is an illusion, remembering that the lower triad here is made up of the physical body, the etheric body, the astral body, and the mental, the physico-etheric being one. The lower triad made up of, but we're told that this is also illusive, that we are misinformed by the impressions that we receive from it. Now, who says this? Who says that this world is an illusion? Plato says it. Blavatsky says it. Ancient Hindus and Chinese traditions teach it. All the great names of the occult say this thing in various ways, that the material world is an illusion. Even Einstein comes to this conclusion ultimately, that the world is unreal in the sense that we have previously regarded it as solid and tangible. Now, if this is true, it puts a very different light on materialism. Let me tell you what I know to be true about material things. Let us assume this is a slab of iron, a piece of iron. We can give its formula and all sorts of things. Iron. Now, it feels, to the finger touch, it feels smooth. It feels cold. It feels solid. It appears silvery, or if it's rusted, it appears reddish. When we hit it, it'll make a clanging noise. All these things come to us through our senses. But let us look at what the iron bar is made of. It is made of, as we well know, billions of tiny little things called atoms, atoms of iron, which may form groups of atoms called molecules, but the whole bar is full of iron atoms. And according to the temperature of the room, the iron atoms are vibrating, moving around. And if we heat the room up more and the iron atoms become heated, they move faster and faster, and ultimately so fast that the iron bar may melt with heat. So we know quite a lot about the atoms. We even know what they're made of. According to science, atoms are made up of a nucleus. A nucleus, which is always quite prominent, a nucleus of protons and neutrons, and that moving around the protons and neutrons, there are electrons, which are tiny little thingies, tiny little particles, originally it was thought. Now, Democritus, the Greek, had said that atoms were just solid little balls of their material. And science held that view up until the late 18th century. So there is an advance towards the proposition that all is energy. All is energy. There's some advances by science. But I want you to do something with me. I want you to take one of these atoms, and I want you to enlarge it in your mind to the size of St. Paul's Cathedral. We'll enlarge it to the size of St. Paul's Cathedral. When we go into the atom and try and see what is inside St. Paul's Cathedral, then we run into a problem, because we find that St. Paul's Cathedral is practically empty. Practically empty. If we have a look at iron or gold or copper, we find that inside the cathedral, there is a group of individuals which for us represent the nuclei of the atom. There are, let's say, 50 or 60 of these individuals clustered together on the main aisle in the center of St. Paul's Cathedral, occupying perhaps no more than that amount of space. And these we are going to regard as the nucleus, the equivalent of the nucleus, if this atom is expanded to the size of St. Paul's Cathedral. The electrons are, in this relationship, about the size of a 5p piece. And the rest of the cathedral is empty. There's the group of priests or public in the middle of the cathedral, and around them there are whirling 5p pieces, the new one, the new 5p piece. And these 5p pieces whirl so fast that you can't locate them. And when you do locate them, they turn out to be a blur of energy. All they are is something like that. A blur of energy. And they're tiny. But the effect of them all rotating around the periphery of the cathedral gives the impression that that is a solid ball. This cathedral is a solid ball. But the atom is empty. Bringing them together with a cohesive force, we have a solid block of iron. But in fact, the tangible amount of material there, the tangible, palpable material there is infinitesimally small. If you were to take the Queen Mary and take all the space out of the Queen Mary, I'm talking about the ship. If you were to take the ship, the Queen Mary, and take all the emptiness out of its atoms, you'd end up with a piece of material about the size of my fist. But it is spread out, it is ironed out, and it is heated, and it is erected and inhabited, and gives us the Queen Mary. But in fact, though you can see it as the Queen Mary and so on, it only occupies a space that size when you collapse all the empty space, take the empty space out. So that's the situation today. But when they start digging in to the electron and digging in to the particles making up the priests, making up St. Paul's Cathedral, they find that even these things are empty. And that's a fact of life. They're beginning to find that dark matter, an energy of dark matter, does occupy the center of these particles that make up the nucleus of the atom. Now let's have a look at the occult teaching. About 130 years ago, a doctor in New York by the name of Babbitt, Dr. Babbitt, published a book called The Theory of Light and Color. The Theory of Light and Color. Lovely book. If you see it in the shops, buy it. It's worth about £300, the original volume. And in this Theory of Light and Color, Dr. Babbitt said, all particles ultimately are reducible. All matter, all physical things are ultimately reduced to one particle, which the theosophists call the Anu, or the ultimate physical particle. Anu, or ultimate physical particle. And it looks something like this. It is a wall of energy, energy in motion, like that. And there are channels within it from the North Pole, from the North Pole to its South Pole. There are channels in it. And these strands of energy and motion here, moving in motion around this object, provide its appearance, its solidity. That was Babbitt, 130 years ago. Before science had begun to come to the same sort of conclusions. How did he know? Then Leadbeater comes along, a clairvoyant, a man who said that somehow he was able to extrude a long tube of etheric material from his brow like a unicorn, and he could look into material and he could steady it. It was better when Annie Besant was next to him or present with him. He could steady the atoms that were moving around, and he could dictate and say what he was looking at. He looked at the nucleus of the atoms and described the nuclei. And so, if you have a handout sheet there, you'll see that things like gold, not in my gold-forming mood, that gold is a radiatory pattern of energy, that carbon has a sort of funnel, quadrate shape, and so on. Now, we're not into occult chemistry this afternoon. I'm merely pointing out the relevant knowledge from the esoteric world and from the scientific world, which pooled together, shows unequivocally that matter is empty and whatever exists there is energy. All the shapes and forms are providing us only with an illusion, not a true statement, not a true demonstration. And when you think of the way that people put their faith, put their hopes and wishes in such material, it is really quite heartbreaking. And yet that is the fact. Now we must, having looked at matter and found it to be illusory, we're not saying it isn't there, we're saying that it is illusory. Our senses tell us things that there's no evidence for. Now we'll go to man, who looks at the Maya. Let's see what man has involved here. When we come to man, we find some very strange things involved. I mean, I've had 8 years at medical schools and elsewhere studying the nature of man physically, never mind my knowledge acquired from ancient wisdom about his etheric, his emotional, his physical, his mental, and his spiritual parts to him. When we look at man, we are surprised to find that the point of consciousness in man has never been located. Even though science will say that there is a point of consciousness somewhere, and then change their attitude so that some say that consciousness hovers over the cortex of the brain. There is no organ, there's no group of tissues, no cells that you can say, here is the site in man, or huge groups of cells, or the whole brain. No evidence for it at all. Let me put it another way. You have a leg amputated in a train crash. The leg is removed. There's vital force in it, which gradually dissipates. No loss of consciousness. No loss of consciousness at all. The memory is unimpaired of the person. His capacity to act as an intellectual being. It's all there still, although he's lost a leg. Take the other leg off. No change. No change. Psychologically, he may be a bit depressed. He has lost half his body weight. And the consciousness is unaffected. Take his arms off. You now have barely a trunk. You may even remove the lower part of the trunk as far as the kidneys with a bit of expert heroic surgery. What have you left? Less than half of the individual and the consciousness remains. You say, well, of course, because the consciousness is in the head. But when you get to the head, you say, ha, now I've got consciousness. Where is it? I know it's not in the eyes. It's behind the eyes. So that part, it's not in front of the midbrain. And it's dead center. But it's not out there. And it's not out there. And it's not behind. It's right in the middle somewhere. But evidence shows that there is no point of consciousness inside an organ in the middle of the brain. So here we have extraordinary things. Like you, I'm an intelligent individual trying to do my best in the world. And here is man who somehow with his brain has got to apprehend things coming into him. How does he apprehend them? Somebody flashes a light. I saw a light go on. Oh, no, you didn't. Oh, no, you didn't. What experience you had was a flow of electricity from a part of the brain. You didn't see light. There is no evidence for that at all. What happened was that light came into the eye. There's the eye. The light came in. It set up a chemical reaction on the back of the eye where there are rods and cone cells. This chemical reaction passed into the optic nerve, which is part of the brain, passed into the optic nerve an electrical action. And the optic nerve took this electrical motion to a part of the brain that I pointed out earlier, to the occipital cortex, where we see the visual area of the brain. And we receive an electrical impulse, and we call it light, but it isn't light that we saw. Now, you can stand on your head and dance backwards and do as you like. You can't get away from these facts. These are the facts of everyday science, the kind of trivia that your kids are learning at school, hopefully a good school. Now, so it doesn't matter whether we see something, in inverted commas, whether we touch it, everything that is seen and touched and heard, felt, whatever you like, is interpreted in the brain from electrical currents. So you have, on the one side, electrical forces in what we're observing, and on the other side, you have electrical forces in the observer. And all we are is a point of consciousness in a mass of atoms and various other devices like molecules and cells and so on that are receiving incoming information. And what is being given to them is a lot of information which is received electrically. The smoothness, the roughness, the coldness, the color, the light, whatever it is. You've got impressions, and that is all. When you walk out of this room, there is no question about it, that what remains here is energy and motion, but not a lecture hall, not for you. Now, as I say, you can do what you like, but those are the facts. And that is why the ancient wisdom has said for centuries what it does, that the outer world is Maya. It is an illusion. It is a hall which is out to entrap the spiritual beings that have been inserted, whose consciousness has been inserted amongst this material world. That consciousness is going to go. It's going to withdraw partly in death, withdraw further during the inter-reincarnatory periods. And ultimately, when man achieves his fully awakened state, that point of consciousness will be removed altogether from the planetary systems and their various globes. Now that is the teaching on Maya, and it means very clearly that much as we like to think elsewise, and much as we value having a bank balance and two cars and a townhouse and a country house and everything else that goes along with the whore's enticement, she entices us so that we do the same dance as she does. We say there's nothing else except this electrical vibration rushing around. There's no God. There's no hope for the future. The past has meant nothing. Our families are only other points of identity within the sea of miasmic energy.